This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The dance around the state budget really picked up the pace over the weekend as key members of the Democratic caucus and the governor's administration met behind closed doors to hash out a new two-year state budget. As Senate Minority Leader Len Fasano told Where We Live on Monday, Republicans were not involved.
Being in the room means you go through it and say, how about if we do this and what do you think of that? We were not in the room, period.
Then details came out, higher taxes on wealthy individuals, corporations, and hospitals, causing a backlash that rippled much further than Hartford, traveling to the studios of Morning Joe on MSNBC yesterday.
You actually have a legislature up there and a governor who has decided they're going to go after the big corporations. They have even one tax, which is ridiculous. It's a tax that they want to put on people who establish their corporate headquarters in Connecticut.
But there are
now, every other state in America will give tax incentives for people to establish.
I
can tell you, Jeff Immelt, if you want to move GE to Pensacola, Florida, they 0% taxes. State income taxes, and they in South Carolina will actually give you tax cuts. Don't do it. Stay where you are. I don't think they're going to raise the taxes, but it is pure insanity, and this is really at the heart of the economic debate that we have had for years.
Okay, so Joe Scarborough isn't a fan. Neither are the heads of big state employers like GE, Travelers, and Aetna, who expressed their concerns. This prompted the scuttling of a planned Monday vote, and as of this morning, the House of Representatives right now is still meeting, arguing over what to keep in the budget and what to strip out. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're here on the final day of the state legislative session. If you want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some of the bills that did pass and what they will mean for you. But we're also going to be trying to get some information about what is happening right now at the state capitol with our own Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
I have a Joe Scarborough headache now. You know, that is the dumbest, most fraudulent news program on television right now and maybe in history. We should play clips like that during our fund drives and say, this is what you'd have if there weren't us.
And that's, yes, maybe we will have more clips later on in the program. He went on about this again today. Nothing like a rich guy who lives in Connecticut complaining about taxes on national television. Anyway, I also want to bring in Arielle Levin Becker. She's a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. The entire Mirror team was there at the Capitol yesterday. You got to leave relatively early, like 1 o'clock in the morning, Arielle.
Yeah, I got out at 1. I was pretty lucky because my colleagues are, some of them are still there.
Some of them are still there. And here's what's happening right now. We're going to get into a little bit of what we know is in this budget deal right now, what's been stripped out of the budget deal. Can you just talk a little bit about the tone, though, yesterday and into the early morning hours of last night? Again, as I said, we were expected to have a vote on this budget deal, which seemed for many Democrats to be all buttoned up on Monday. Then Monday comes and goes. Tuesday comes and goes. And now they're still debating it now. What was going on last night?
So last night, there was initially some thought that the House was going to debate sort of the second version of the budget deal. And it just kind of kept going and going. There were a lot of questions about whether they had the votes. And so for a while, they were debating other bills. And then around about 5:30 this morning, I gather, after some members who opposed the bill elected to go home, which would lower the number needed to pass the budget, they began debate in the House.
Well, so they were actually, it was suggested to them that they go home, right? I mean,
actually suggested to them that they go home. So what we
That's how Arielle got to go home early. She said she was going to vote no on the budget. She said, oh, that's good. You should go home then.
Actually, it's a great out.
Actually, this interesting little piece of detail from our friend Chris Keating in the Hartford Current this morning, talking to a lawmaker, said flatly the House did not vote on Monday because Democrats lacked the 76 votes necessary for passage. He said you need 76 trombones in the orchestra before the chorus sings loud. We're missing some trumpeters and drummers. The orchestra pit is not totally filled yet. So the numbers weren't there, Colin, for the vote on the budget. And it seems as though some of the taxes that companies were a little bit worried about are now out of this new bill. Some are still left in.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, this is going on right now, and the Republicans just did mount an amendment to take out the so-called unitary tax. That's the one that Joe Scarborough was complaining about, and the data processing tax. But as far as I know, that amendment failed, and those things are still in the budget. But this is, they say, a developing situation. I will say this, a couple of things. I mean, Ariel was kind of saying this before we went on the air. I mean, if you were from outer space and you just looked at this place, the state capitol, at a time like this, like the last 2 or 3 days of the session, it would be a long time before you figured out they were trying to make laws. I mean, it kind of doesn't look like that. Sort of bells ring and people run around and, you know, it looks like it's some kind of really disorderly game. But this in particular is, I mean, I don't know how at the end of this process, Representative Candelora was saying this morning. God help me, I was watching the budget debate on CTN this morning. But this is a bad budget. I mean, I think almost anybody would agree this is a bad budget. I think the people who are trying to muster support for this budget right now know in their hearts it's a bad budget. It's a budget that's sort of so confusing that I don't even think – I mean, for example, and this is a point that Candelora made, there's property tax abatement or a car tax abatement in this budget. In other words, there's money designated for the state sales tax that would be earmarked for property for car tax reduction, and there's some monitoring too. In other words, if you try to spend it on other stuff, they get mad at you. I forget what they do. They aim a beam at your town or something. And on the other hand, there's the removal of the property tax exemption that you would get in your state income taxes. And this really could wash out. In other words, your town could wind up apportioning you about $100 in property tax relief and car tax relief as a result of the sales tax earmarking. And you could lose it anyway on your state income tax.
And of course, this is an exemption that was $500 a couple years ago, down to $300 now. From what I understand this morning, Ariel, and this all could change, of course, this is one of the contentious measures that's been changed slightly. The idea that this delay, there would be a delay now on the pullback of this tax until next year. It wouldn't take place right away, but it still seems as though this is the sort of place where lawmakers and the governor are going to try to raise revenue right now.
Right. What's in the budget at this point is that the property tax credit that people can claim on their income taxes would drop from $300 to $200. Originally, that had been happening in the first year of the 2-year budget. That was moved to the first year. Nothing would change the second year. It would drop to $200. And I believe the threshold at which you would qualify for that full credit, it drops as your income goes up. That would be lowered, too. So there would be sort of more of a middle-class tax increase.
Now, you're a healthcare reporter. One of the things that we want to get to, an awful lot of things having to do with healthcare that are in the bill, but on the tax side, 2 days ago we were saying cigarette taxes weren't in there. We have one of the highest cigarette tax loads in the entire country, and now it looks like cigarette taxes are back in.
Yes. As of yesterday and currently in the bill is over 2 years, it would be a 50-cent increase in the cigarette tax. That was done to help offset both the delay in reducing the property tax credit and also to somewhat reduce one of the really controversial business taxes, the tax on data processing services that's really concerned some business groups. The tobacco companies have pointed out that they call it a regressive tax because if you look at who their customers are, the people who smoke in Connecticut, it tends to be poor people, a lot of people with mental illness.
Those tobacco companies are looking out for poor people. It's really nice to hear that.
The other thing I will point out is that although they're going to be raising the cigarette tax, there's nothing in the budget to help people quit smoking. The state gets a lot of money every year from a settlement from tobacco companies. And in theory, a few million dollars, up to $12 million a year, can go toward health programs, including things that would help people quit smoking. A lot of times when there's a budget crunch, that money gets raided and taken for other purposes, including the next 2-year budget. So they're going to be raising money off of smokers, but if they need help quitting, there's not going to be any new programs for them.
One way to help them quit smoking, Colin, is to raise the cigarette tax to the point where you can't really afford them anymore. Although we saw this in New Jersey some years ago, they raised the cigarette tax so high that they actually had a hole in the budget because so few people actually smoked that they didn't raise the revenues that they were expecting to raise.
Or people were getting cigarettes in some other way, which is I wish it were the case that people started quitting right away when cigarettes got too expensive. But I think the likelihood is that they explored the borders of their state or other means of obtaining cigarettes.
And there are slightly lower taxes.
I think from Polly Walnuts, for example, you can get them really cheap.
You can get them really cheap. He found a guy off the back of a truck. Well, you know, in states like Massachusetts and Rhode Island, the cigarette taxes are high, but not as high as they would be under this new plan in Connecticut. We're talking about the state budget here, and literally the state budget is being baked baked, as it were, in a gigantic, strange oven down the road from us right now called the State Capitol. Colin McEnroe is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Arielle Levin-Becker is a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We hope to hear from some of our colleagues who are down at the Capitol right now trying to figure out what's going on. If you have questions and thoughts about the state budget, 860.
Or if you think that you understand it, please call in immediately.
Because we don't understand it at all. 860-275-7266. Arielle?
Well, I just wanted to explain a little bit about how we got here. So we started out with what looked like almost a $3 billion deficit in the next 2 years that needed to be closed. And so the governor came up and proposed some tax increases and some really large social service spending cuts that legislators from both parties really disliked and proposed getting rid of. The Democrats proposed reversing a lot of those cuts by raising taxes. The Republicans propose reversing a lot of those cuts by making a lot of cuts toward money that's spent on state employees. And the final budget, which was negotiated and sort of came to a resolution over the weekend, there still are a lot of social service cuts, but compared to what the governor proposed, they actually are comparatively very modest. So sort of an interesting perspective thing. You're not hearing a lot of criticism of them, I think, because of where things started out. In fact, some of the sort of social service advocacy groups were really pushing for the budget to pass yesterday.
Without having to get into a whole lot of numbers off the top of your head, maybe you can give us some examples. When we heard about the cuts in the governor's original budget, many folks who were worried about the social services, the safety net in the state, were quite worried. You say they're relatively modest now. What are some examples?
So, for example, a lot of the cuts the governor proposed that would affect people with developmental disabilities, a lot of those have been reduced substantially. There was a proposal to cut a program that helps families who have children and teenagers with developmental disabilities and a mental health diagnosis. The governor would have cut that by 60%. It would be cut by 10% under the budget. Things like that where, you know, number-wise, it's still going to be a big cut in dollars, but much less than was proposed before. One of the cuts that was very controversial, which would have scaled back Medicaid eligibility and cut off about 34,000 people, including pregnant women, that was cut back. It would still lower the income limit, but not by as much as the governor proposed. And the thinking is about 20 to 25,000 people would probably lose coverage. No pregnant women would be affected. Their income limit wouldn't change. At this point, I think the real controversy is around the tax package. Over the weekend, they were negotiating on Saturday, late Saturday around midnight. They came out and said they had a deal. Over the weekend, they presented it and they talked about it. Things like higher income tax on the wealthy, some additional taxes on corporations, including this controversial unitary combined reporting and the tax on data processing, which would triple. One thing they did not mention, however, was this property tax credit reduction, this essentially tax increase on the middle class. My colleague Keith Faniff reported that on Monday, and it seemed like that, along with a lot of pushback from companies about the corporate taxes, really pushed the budget into disarray. And so the budget vote that was supposed to take place on Monday didn't happen. Yesterday, there were some adjustments, such as some slight reductions in the really controversial taxes. The business community said, you know, that's really too little.
Well, and we've been hearing about that, and that's what Joe Scarborough was barking about, Colin McEnroe. So let's take this on the two ends of this. You said earlier on, this is a bad budget, something in it to hate for everybody. But as Arielle reports, look, an awful lot of the really nasty cuts that were coming to social services in the state, those seem to have been reduced. We seem to have mitigated some of the problems on one end of the spectrum, at least. Before we get to GE, let's talk about that.
Yeah. First of all, I want to salute Arielle for an unbelievably cogent explanation of something that I regard as hopelessly chaotic. I couldn't have done that to save my life. First of all, I'm not sure that the final bell has rung in all this, you know, and certainly as things come into play. Once again, those highly vulnerable groups of people who receive social services from the state are going to be highly vulnerable. So I'm not sure that this whole thing is over. And I think also, I mean, in a way, when you listen to what she says, you see that the problem is that the Democrats in some ways want to do the right thing, at least around social services, and put some of this money back in. But there isn't really money to pay for it without, in fact, going to some tax places that people don't really want to go to. So, I mean, that almost sums up the impasse, the semi-impasse that we're at right now, that both the Republicans and the Democrats didn't have the appetite, really, to inflict the kind of pain that the governor's budget inflicted on various populations. On the other hand, I'm not sure either side has really developed an honest, palatable, workable, passable way of funding the difference.
So on the other side of...
Does that seem right? I now trust you because you clearly have a better perspective on this than I do.
Well I just have to ask though. So on the other side of this, and we talked about this a little bit on our live show on Monday night down at Black Eyed Sally's, we were talking a little bit about what was in and what was out of the state budget. Our friend Danny Hart from the Hartford Current was talking about this assault essentially on 21st century economy, the idea that Connecticut, as they try to not shred the social safety net, as they try to not make some other tough choices, they're essentially going after some of the biggest employers in the state. We've heard a couple days of this from GE, from Travelers, from Aetna, now Boehringer Ingelheim. I mean, well, I'll ask you first, Ariel, what do we make of some of these threats? We're hearing lawmakers and other people say, well, this is pretty serious stuff here. Are lawmakers really listening to what GE and their friends are saying?
You know, I think it is definitely something that gives people pause. You know, it's not something that you hear typically, these big companies weighing in, particularly, you know, yesterday, Boehringer Ingelheim sort of joined in. They're a pharmaceutical company. And that's the kind of business that the governor's been talking about trying to attract to Connecticut, bioscience. So, you know, I think, you know, business groups often talk about the business climate in the state and having concerns about the message that is sent by state policy. And certainly, you know, companies are saying this is going to be a real problem.
But it gets to this other question, Colin, about being held up by business once again. At a certain point, what does the state do if GE says we're going to move, whether or not it's because of slightly higher taxes on people making over $500,000 a year, combined with the unitary tax and these data processing taxes and other things that are going to cost corporations more? I mean, at this point, does Connecticut just say, okay, we give, we're going to give you what you want?
You know, I think it is possible and responsible to be kind of ambivalent about this question. Although I will say one piece of this that I'm not ambivalent about. This conversation should have happened a really long time ago, and this unitary tax really kind of popped out of nowhere. You know, the way to have done this would have been to have these companies at the table for a series of meetings months ago. And I think one of the reasons they're freaking out is I don't think they really saw this coming. And so that's step one. I mean, step two is, you know, the unitary tax. I mean, one of the reasons that this is being proposed is for these companies that kind of don't really pay taxes much of anywhere because they have the kind of multiple locations.
Famously, GE doesn't pay any taxes anywhere.
Right.
That's their business model.
So, I mean, I think it's possible on the one hand to sort of say, wow, you know, it makes some sense to ask them to step up and be a citizen of the state and participate in these in funding state government, particularly in these hard times. On the other hand, for the amount of money that they're raising with this new tax that's causing everybody from GE to Joe Scarborough to freak out, when you compare that against the money that Malloy has shoved in tax incentives at companies that he wants to either have locate here or keep here, it does seem like there's a problem. They're risking an awful lot right now over not all that much money from this unitary tax, certainly compared to what they've been willing to spend to get and keep companies.
And I think part of Colin's point to Ariel is if you sit down at the table over time with these companies, maybe you can craft a deal. Coming at this 11th hour, it felt to everyone we talked to at the Capitol that this did come out of nowhere, and it almost feels punitive. Like it's a fair thing to do to ask the GEs of the world and the Travelers of the world to pay a little bit more. But when you ask them like this, it doesn't play so well.
Yeah, the combined report and the unitary tax was included in the package that the Finance Committee proposed about a month ago, maybe a little less than that. But at the time, you know, it wasn't really clear what was going to be in the final deal. And I think that was considered, you know, one of the bigger stretches, and then it ended up in the final deal. And to Colin's point, the legislature's nonpartisan fiscal analysts have said that, you know, it's very difficult to predict what you're actually going to bring in with that tax. In other states that have it, you know, one year they might see an increase in tax of 26%. Next year they might see a reduction, in part, I think, because companies adjust to it. So, you know, it's relatively speaking not a gigantic revenue gain compared to some other things. For example, increased tax on capital gains income would have raised much more. That was taken off the table.
I got to take a break. When we come back, we'll try to understand this a little bit more. We're going to come back with Keith Faniff, the capital budget guru who just called us up. We're going to be right back with him in the wheelhouse where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, a special edition of The Wheelhouse, as there's actually live action happening in the background of the state capitol, and we're trying to figure out what's happening with the state budget. We're joined by Colin McEnroe and R.L. Levin Becker from the Connecticut Mirror in studio. Our friend Keith Faniff, who's the state budget guru for the Mirror, joins us right now on the phone from the capitol. Keith, what's going on down there?
Well, I apologize for the grogginess in my voice, but they are getting close to House approval of the budget that would end, well, a debate that began at 5:20 this morning, but really a process that began at about 11 a.m. yesterday.
So this is why you sound so groggy. What can you tell us is in this budget and out of the budget that we maybe thought was going to be there, Keith?
Well, I'm tempted to describe it as budget money sleeping now, but I'll try to go in a little more detail. You've got a huge tax increase when you consider that, you know, we were talking at this time a year ago about actually passing out about $500 million in tax cuts. That's how much the legislature had approved and Governor Malloy had signed last year at this time to take effect over the first two fiscal years after the biennium. And the interesting thing about that is the actual forecast for the upcoming two fiscal years, the deficit projections, really are the same now that they were then. What's changed is the election is over. What we're looking at, though, is we're looking at income tax increases both on the wealthy and on the middle class. We're looking at a wide array of increases in the corporation tax, including some very controversial proposals, something called unitary reporting, where we're going to try to take a look at all of a company's holdings and subsidiaries, both in Connecticut and outside of Connecticut, before we really determine just how much in taxes they owe the state. We're looking at a broadening of the sales tax, nowhere near as broad as we had been talking about before, mainly picking up things like data processing services. That's another thing the businesses are upset about. On the spending side, we do have a budget that really plays defense. I'm sure Ariel talked about the cuts to social services are nowhere near as extensive as people had been talking about. Probably the biggest item is about $430 million over the next 2 years that would go to cities and towns. Presumably this would be to mitigate property tax hikes at that level. There is a matching amount of money going into the transportation fund. The reason people aren't jumping up and down about that, though, is at the same time, we're putting $430 million of sales tax money into the transportation fund. We're cutting off the flow of another $370 million that was supposed to go into transportation. So it certainly in some people's eyes, it looks like some more transportation money is being diverted.
Keith, one of the things you and your colleagues at the Mirror wrote the other day that I think is important from a framing mechanism here is an understanding of where these tax increases are exactly hitting. It's easy to read the top line numbers and say, well, there's a modest tax increase for people who make over $500,000 a year. There's some corporate taxes as well. But if you look at this in totality, there really is a tax increase that's going to hit people in Connecticut across the board.
Absolutely. Just some real quick math. Again, we talked about over the next 2 years, cities and towns getting it's $436 million. Let's just assume, even though this isn't likely to happen, let's assume every penny of that goes into lowering property taxes. And some of it, of course, won't. It'll be spent on different services that communities need. Now let's try to match up money on the other side. The middle class will be losing about $150 million with an income tax increase. They'll be reducing the amount of money you can get on your refund next year by reducing a credit you can claim against property taxes you pay. The middle class is losing. Everybody's losing, but the middle class are seen as the prime beneficiaries of the sales tax exemption on clothing costing less than $50. That's worth $280 million in this budget. The working poor are losing a $22 million income tax break that was signed in the last term, carries over to this one. So just really quickly, right there, we've identified $450 million. Some are arguing that middle class paying for this property tax money, this money going to the towns, with their own tax relief by forfeiting it.
By forfeiting it. And Keith, I know you've got to go because you got to get back to work. So I thank you very much for calling in and in your own groggy way trying to explain what's happening down there. I hope you get some sleep sometime soon, and maybe we'll check back in with you later on today.
Sounds good.
Keith Faniff is the budget guru for the Connecticut Mirror. He loves this stuff normally, but he sounds somewhat beaten down, Ariel and Colin. Well, I wanted to get to that point. Before we move on from the tax piece of this, I think the reporting that Ariel and Keith and Mark Pazniokas, Jackie Rabe Thomas, everyone at the Mirror has done, and certainly the other Capital Press Corps, has made it pretty clear that this is a budget that it does include some pain for just about everyone. This isn't just about taxing the rich, right?
Well, yeah, although, no, there's a lot of pain, actually. And, you know, what Keith just said, I hadn't really thought about it this way, but if you listen to what Keith just said, the car tax abatement looks even worse in the sense that everybody at all parts of the income continuum can benefit from a lowering of the mill rate in their town on car taxes. So if, in fact, the middle class and people below middle class are paying a commensurate price in terms of these other modifications, it really isn't. I mean, it really might be kind of a net loss for the middle class.
We're getting some tweets from people. Neil says, what's it going to take for a state as liberal and as broke as ours to consider legalization and taxation of marijuana? Thank you very much, Neil. Ken Dixon, our friend, the reporter, calls this the vampire rush hour budget of 2015. Nancy says, so do these big corporations and bullies who pay no taxes benefit from the Roland administration policies, which are largely responsible for this mess? And we're hearing from Representative Matt Lesser, who's tweeted that he's now been at the state capitol for 24 straight hours. If you have any thoughts, it's 860-275-7266. You can tweet us at Where We Live. You can also find us on Facebook at Where We Live as we try to explain what's going on at the state capitol right now as best we can with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Ariel Levenbecker, the reporter for The Connecticut Mirror, who covers health and health care. And maybe we can talk through what's in a big health care bill that passed earlier this week. And there's so much to talk about around the state budget, around taxes and about social services. But there's an awful lot that has to do with our health and hospitals that is, well, this is really big stuff, Ariel. Maybe you can take us through point by point here.
Sure. Yes, there was a really big health care bill that passed the House and Senate in the last few days. Flew a little bit under the radar, I think, but contained a lot of provisions. It really grew out of work by Len Fasano and Martin Looney, who are respectively the Senate Minority Leader and Senate President, so the top Democrat and Republican in the Senate. And they're both from the New Haven area. And they both have a lot of concerns about the growth of large health systems that control a lot of hospitals and doctors and what they say are sort of monopolistic practices that they think can raise healthcare costs. And so they put together a proposal that was very controversial. A lot of consumer advocates, patient safety folks really liked a lot of the stuff. A lot of people in the healthcare industry had real concerns about it. And ended up working out something that was a little bit of a compromise, though still strongly opposed by hospitals. There's a lot in the bill. I think probably the thing that patients will most notice and maybe one of the less controversial provisions had to do with transparency. So over the next couple of years, at least based on what's in this bill, people should be much more able to find out what the cost of healthcare services will be before they get them. And that's something that's really important for people who have high deductible plans, which are becoming more common because you go to the doctor, you often would end up paying whatever your insurance company has negotiated. And sometimes it's pretty difficult to find out in advance what that's going to be.
And what's the real cost of this? What's the cost if I have this plan versus that plan? I go to one place versus another place. We've reported on this here, and it is one of the most confusing things, especially when you're being asked to or told to under an HSA plan, manage your own health care.
Right. So under this bill, the Health Insurance Exchange Access Health CT would have to develop a website that would have information where people could compare prices for care at different locations. Insurance companies would also have to make it easier for people to find that information out. Right now, a lot of healthcare contracts with insurance companies actually prohibit them from disclosing what it would cost for you to get care. So even if you called up and tried to do your homework, you wouldn't be able to. That would be banned under this bill. So people would be able to get that information. They'd also be notified in some cases if they were going to a provider that was not in their insurer's network, and which might lead them to paying higher costs. So that's a big transparency piece. There are also some things that have to do with disclosure of what's called facility fees, which are additional charges that people can sometimes face if they go to, for example, an outpatient center that's owned by a hospital. They might pay more. And so there'd have to be more disclosure of that. And in 2017, some of those fees would actually be banned in the state.
This all seems like pretty common sense stuff. Obviously, the hospitals are opposing a lot of these things. How much is it going to cost the hospitals? I mean, do we have some sort of a number as far as what the hospitals are going to say? Well, this is the nut and we can't afford it.
That piece of it, I don't know that there's going to be as much cost. There was some reporting requirements in an earlier version of the bill that hospitals were really concerned about that was taken out, and more of the reporting will have to be done by insurance companies. The parts the hospitals are more concerned about have to do with one of the really controversial ones was additional requirements for state approval of any kind of sale of a hospital. A lot of the state's independent hospitals are looking to join larger networks just as kind of a way of survival. And there's been a lot of concern in the state about consolidation among hospitals, the potential entrance of for-profit companies. And so the bill would add some factors that state regulators would have to consider before they approve a hospital sale. And for sales that involve either for-profit companies or large hospitals or large hospital systems, there would actually be an additional process that would include a market impact review, and the purchaser would have to pay for an independent monitor for 3 years. They'd have to provide information about services, you know, what kind of services would be delivered in the future years after the sale. So hospitals see that as, you know, potentially making it more difficult.
Well, I want to get a take from Colin here on this because, you know, we were told at our Wheelhouse Uncensored event the other night that, you know, we don't spend enough time talking about some of the really good things that happen up at the Capitol and some of the good pieces of legislation. It seems to me from everything that Ariel has outlined right there, there's an awful lot of common sense stuff that probably will help consumers, that will probably help people get information they need.
Yeah, I mean, my wildly underinformed take on this bill is that it's actually a pretty good bill, and it actually represents maybe the General Assembly's process when it works correctly. I think, first of all, as Ariel was kind of alluding to, Fasano and Looney have worked better together than Sharkey and Claritas have. And as a result, you get – and I think down in the House, Matt Ritter, people like that have done some good work on this bill too. So it does seem as though this is the kind of legislation you would really want a high-functioning General Assembly to come up with, which is a certain amount of push and pull, walking a little bit of a knife's edge between making the hospital sector super unhappy and delivering some much-needed reforms. And I think given the revisions – it's harder now for anybody to claim that they're the aggrieved party. And there are some pretty substantial improvements which need to be made and which address the changes that we're seeing in the hospital industry.
Amongst those changes, though, and the things that the hospital industry is talking about here, we'll get back to taxes. New taxes in this plan on hospitals, this is something that they're very worried about. They want more money from the state. It looks like they're going to get more taxes.
Yeah, I believe the budget proposal would increase the amount of money that hospitals have to pay and not give them a whole lot more back. And that's been one of the complaints of hospitals through this process. I mean, with the bill we were just talking about, you know, there are not a whole lot of industries that like to be more regulated in general. But one of the complaints that you've heard from hospital officials in particular is that while the state has been cutting the amount of money that they receive and increasing the taxes they pay, it's also adding regulations that make it harder for them to do things that would adapt and help them become more efficient and spend less money. And so they sort of feel like they're being cut off in a lot of different directions.
Colin?
And once again, you know so much more about this than I do, but don't they also feel as though the schedule for taxation and reimbursement that was set up for them in 2011 is not being adhered to, right? The rules keep getting changed. And I did read – people who think economists are boring have clearly never met Fred Carstensen. So I did read Fred Carstensen's somewhat fiery and hysterical analysis of this tax, which he doesn't think is very good and which he thinks actually may have sort of bullet effect consequences that actually just hurt revenue and hurt the budget. But I think one legitimate thing the hospitals can say, please correct me if I'm wrong, is you set this up one way in 2011 and you keep changing it.
Yeah, the hospital tax is sort of relies on this weird loophole in federal law where the state can tax hospitals and then return the money. And by returning that money to the industry, the state can actually claim matching funds from the federal government through Medicaid. So initially, the tax was created as a way for the state to get money from the federal government, and the hospital industry would pay in. They would receive the money back. What's happened over time, though, is that the amount they pay in has increased and the amount they get back has decreased. And so one of the criticisms of that, besides the hospital industry just saying that's unfair and sort of different than what we originally had thought, is that because the state is returning less to the industry, we're no longer getting that federal matching money. So we're leaving a lot of federal dollars on the table.
And one quick point to make is that, you want a somewhat robust hospital sector if you're trying to rebuild your state's economy with biosciences, right? So that's a big part of the Molloy strategy, you know, Jackson Labs and everything that goes along with it. Well, at a certain point, they get tired of, you know, testing stuff on mice and monkeys. You know, they really want to be able to go to the hospitals and work with them. You want a robust clinical sector. It's even, I think, argued that one reason that Pfizer made some of the moves that it made, you know, they want to be up there in Cambridge near those hospitals. So you don't want to completely screw or demoralize the hospitals.
Colin McEnroe is here. He's host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Arielle Levin-Becker is a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror who covers health and healthcare and also the state budget, which is what's on our mind right now. At the moment, the House of Representatives, they're having a debate over the state budget. The session is supposed to end midnight tonight. We'll find out if we have a state budget. We're also talking about other things that did get passed at the Capitol. You can join us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live, or give us a call at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the Women's World Cup kicks off next week under the shadow of the FIFA scandal. We'll check the pulse of soccer in America. The sport was, of course, huge after last year's exciting Men's World Cup. But what has happened since? What about youth soccer? Does this week's news affect at all the soccer moms, dads, and their minivans? We're talking soccer coming up tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, we're talking about the state budget in the wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable with Arielle Levin-Becker, a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, and also Colin McEnroe, who joins us as always. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
I'm not sure whether it fits into what we're talking about now or not, but I feel like it fits into everything. We're doing a show about patterns, particularly about the fact that patterns exist in nature and that the ability to recognize patterns is part of the key to any species survival. It's pattern recognition is something that people are good at, but it's also tricky because if you're like Keith Faniff and you have very little sleep and you're not getting enough oxygen, you know, you start to see patterns where there aren't any. And that's called apophenia. There's actually a name for it. You start to see patterns. You know, I'm sure if Keith walks outside right now, he looks up at the clouds, they're going to be spelling out some message, you know, about property tax credits or something. So at that point, you have to get a little worried.
So that should be a fun show this afternoon at 1 o'clock with Colin McEnroe on the Colin McEnroe Show. So let's talk about some things that have actually gotten done. We actually got a tweet from Rachel, and a lot of people, by the way, are joining us on Twitter right now at Where We Live in various forms. She says the budget includes flat funding of education that is basically a cut, and you haven't even mentioned hashtag charter schools. Well, I know you wanted to mention charter schools, Colin, because there's two different levels to it. One is increased charter school funding, but also with that, a little bit more charter school accountability.
Yeah, and I actually sort of think that this is one of the watchwords of a General Assembly that's a little bit stalled, is if you can't do something substantive, you at least increase accountability. So with charter schools, I mean, obviously they went through scandals last year, and a lot of questions about, first of all, how do you keep track of how they're spending money, but also sort of, you know, how do you in fact evaluate the results and stuff like that. So they have actually passed a charter school accountability bill, which is probably a pretty good idea. But, you know, I don't even know. I have lost track of the $20 million or whatever it was that was in the budget for the two new state charter schools. I know Malloy was insisting that it stay in. I assume it's still in there.
I'm assuming it's still in there, and I've not heard anything that says it isn't. Well, let's talk more about accountability. Gary Winfield had been working very hard on a police accountability bill, which on the surface, Colin, you say looks pretty good.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried about the status of the bill, though. So this is a bill, and I'm going to have to look at notes here for a second, because it does a lot of different things. It establishes standards for investigating officer-related shootings. It talks about equipping police with body cameras and does, I think, create a pool of $13 million, but that's not available until 2017, when Keith will figure out where we could get some money for that. But I think that some of that comes in grant form, too. So anyway, a pool of money for the body cameras. This does some of the things that we were hoping that would be done. It also requires changes in police training and hiring, subjects departments to liability if police illegally stop a citizen from recording them, stuff like that. So it is, I believe, now past the Senate. There are some real questions. This is a bill that Representative Claridis, the new minority leader in the House, has kind of indicated she doesn't really like all that much. She's certainly in a position to stop it if she wants to. The Republicans have a lot of traction right now with the filibuster option. So she, just the way that a cop can pull you over and keep you there for a while, she could say this bill has a busted taillight and it might not get down the road.
Well, another one of these bills, Ariel, and I don't know if you know the status of it right now, the Second Chance Society legislation that Governor Malloy pushed so hard that, of course, has to deal with sentencing guidelines. And it really was an attempt to try to bring together the right and the left around the idea that people maybe don't need to spend dozens and dozens and dozens of years in jail for fairly minor offenses. What do we know about the status of that right now?
That made it through the Senate last night. I don't believe it's come up in the House yet. And as Colin said, the House has limited time now. There's a midnight deadline. I don't know whether that's going to sail through or whether that's going to be something that if the minority party wants to spend a lot of time talking about it, we'll just not go through.
As of yesterday, Ariel's colleague, Mark Pazniokas, pointed out that there were 215 bills that had unichamber approval. In other words, one chamber had approved them, the other one hadn't. And they're just, even forget about filibusters, just an actual reasonably responsible use of time would still suggest that many things that have been approved in one chamber won't. Now, I think the Second Chance legislation it's so big that if it doesn't pass, I'll be interested to see what Dan Malloy, if it doesn't get acted on, if it sits there, if it dies because it doesn't get the vote from the other chamber, I'll be interested to see what Dan Malloy does about that, because this is really big, and I actually do think it's pretty important, too. I don't know. I maybe a special session is sort of out of the question. But
much like this police accountability bill, it seems to address something that right now America is grappling with. And in some ways, Connecticut needs to figure out a way to do that. If it doesn't get done around this time crunch around the end of the legislative session, maybe it is something that deserves a special session. We're getting more tweets. Alex says the state budget is progressive. Any relief from property taxes can be spun as higher state taxes. It took courage to do reform. Deb Poland says 20 to 25,000 people are still being kicked off Husky, so all health providers still need to be around and able to serve the uninsured. If you want to join us, it's at Where We Live. Jim's in Plainville now. Hi there, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live. Hi, Jim. You're there. Oh, my goodness. Jim's gone. No more Jim. So, Ariel, on a day like this, as we try to figure out what's going to be in and out of the state budget, how are you guys exactly handling the things that you're looking at? We've got a midnight deadline. We've got a whole bunch of reporters up there probably hearing leaks and other things. And we haven't even talked about how this all gets rolled into one big bill at the very end. It seems like in the days to come, we're going to be finding all sorts of little gems that are tucked into this budget bill that we probably haven't even talked about at all on this show or at all for several months.
Yeah, that actually generally happens in a different bill called an implementer, which has a lot of the policy changes required to implement the budget. So far as I know, those bills have not come out. It's possible that there could be a special session to deal with that, with those alone. That's happened in the past. The budget bill itself, I've read it a couple of times. I'm pretty confident about what's in there. But once you get to the implementer, that's the sort of thing people crawl through and find all sorts of gems. And a lot of times things that don't get through in separate bills end up rolled into an implementer.
Everybody in the House and Senate will get an emerald. They're actually actual gems in the bill. Yeah, I actually don't see how they can do it. I mean, within the time that they've got. I don't see how they can pass this budget and then roll out an implementer. It just doesn't really even seem possible.
We got another message on Facebook here. Sean Lang, who's very involved in this this issue, says HB 6856, an act concerning opiate overdose. It passed the House unanimously and needs to be called and passed in the Senate. This is another one of these bills we're talking about. If the number's 215 that have passed one House REL and haven't passed another, maybe they die because of this today. Maybe they go on. Are there any other bills that you're watching today that you're thinking might actually get passed in this last flurry of activity?
You know, there's a large number. I will point out that particularly bills that will pass that have passed unanimously in one chamber, particularly those that are waiting in the Senate can get through a lot of bills pretty quickly. So there is hope for some of the non-controversial bills, I would say. A couple tidbits from the budget, just in case anyone's curious. There's $50,000 for election monitoring in Hartford for the 2020.
That'll go a long way.
There's also $50,000 for animal control in Bethlehem.
$50,000. So there's this, I just
want
to make sure.
There was an animal hoarder situation, yeah. And the town spent a lot of money taking care of abused dogs.
So there's as much money in the budget to monitor the elections in Hartford and animal control in Bethlehem.
That's
right.
Correct.
The budget also makes changes in alcohol policy, allowing restaurants and bars to sell larger sealed containers of beer for off-premises consumption. So. Beer to go. Yay.
And not just beer to go, but big beers
big
to go.
Beer, big
hey, and Colin, I guess we can't sort of end today without talking just a little bit about one of our favorite subjects. You know, we talked the other day during our live show about Keno still being in the budget. The fact of the matter is that we're now seeing that something like $13 million is being put in the budget projections for Keno in this first year. The hope is, amongst those who support the bill, that it would get up to $30 million and then just grow from there. As we've done reporting on in the past, there's almost no way to know that $13 million is a realistic number for how much Keno will generate in the state this first year.
No, they have no clue, and they can't even really make a coherent case for it. Before we run out of time, I also want to mention that last night at 2 in the morning, the House passed titanium as the state metal or element or whatever it's supposed to be. So I don't know if we have gems, but we have titanium. You know, in terms of Keno, I mean, Jeff Berger, whose name we haven't said so far today, but who's really become kind of the point man for a lot of these budget talks in the House, you know, he's sort of saying, well, this isn't a quick revenue grab. This is really about sort of the more complex Cheesecake Factory menu of gambling that we want to have in the state and sort of making sure we're competitive with other states and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's kind of like, well, make up your mind. It's either about the money or it's because we really want to offer this incredibly diverse panoply of gambling and leave no gambling stone unturned, not because we're desperate and greedy and grubby for the money, which we're obviously going to be pulling out of the off the backs of working people and the kinds of people who use Keno but can't really afford to, you know, I mean, which is it? You know, is it a revenue stream or is it something that you want to do to diversify your gambling population?
Well, and that's when we just have about a minute and a half left, Ariel, but I think that is one of the questions here. There are certain things like the cigarette tax, which we brought up before, which now it seems is back in the state budget. That is a tax that is meant to do two things. It's meant to raise money and it's also meant to hopefully get people to change their behavior. Instituting Keno is meant to maybe raise money or maybe, as Colin suggested, diversify our gambling opportunities in the state. But it also incentivizes in some ways not that great behavior that can really, some say, tax those who can least afford to play.
Yeah, absolutely. You hear that from a lot of people who have concerns about problem gambling, have really major concerns about Keno in particular because it would be available in so many places. There's a lot of money raised in the budget through gambling, cigarettes, and alcohol.
And one last thing for you, Colin. The Glanville bill that we talked about passed Senate, and I guess that Dan Malloy actually has the Glanville bill now.
Yeah, it went through the Senate on consent. It's sort of a complicated subject, but it involves the ability of officers to pursue and make arrests across town lines on violations of municipal ordinance in sort of non-emergency situations. In other words, it's not like there's blood on the ground or something like that.
Well, I was just going to say, whenever people say that we don't talk about some of the things that actually did get passed, that the lawmakers did do. We spent some time talking about those things today. We got some things done, right, Colin?
I feel really good about myself.
Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Arielle Levenbecker from the Connecticut Mirror. This is Where We Live.